The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
What? Welcome back to Breaking Banks. It's Brett King. I am in the studio live from New York. Live from New York, yes. And it's not Saturday night. It's only Thursday afternoon. And with me in the studio is Dave Annamalai. Hey, so Dave, where are you from?
I'm originally from India. I live in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Okay. And you work for who?
Pfizer.
So welcome to the show today. So it's great to have you on. Hey, we've got a couple of other guests we're going to announce shortly, but given that Dave is one of the FinTech Mafia and he's in the studios with me, I thought we'd kick off with that. So there's a lot going on this week. Of course, the big news, lots of politics. Don't want to get too much into that. Although it's looking like Watson 2016 is an even better bet than before, IBM Watson for president. So we're going to be talking about some of the sort of regulatory stuff and some politics around regulation in the future first. But before that, there is some news. Obviously, you guys heard about John Stumpf, the CEO of Wells, the latest casualty. After the congressional hearings, particularly with the beat-up he got from Elizabeth Warren, it's not surprising that things are sort of going that way for Stumpf. So we'll see what that is. He had to forego $41 million in his remuneration as well. So pretty painful day. Although I think his equity in Wells is probably worth a couple hundred million, so not maybe that painful. Some of the other news that's coming up. We also see. A lot of commentary on the fact that JP Morgan Chase has made a $100 million investment in a firm, Max Levchin's business today. So that's big news. And also, a little bit of a cool thing, Nationwide out of the UK took their contactless card to the edge of space, 100,000 feet above the Earth, to test their card in a weather balloon. And brought it back to Earth to see if it would work. So this is some of the news that's happening right now. But before we get to the show, don't forget the media partner FinDevor. They have their FinDevor Silicon Valley event coming up on October 18 and 19, and they're going to be showcasing their latest tools, platforms, case studies for all those techies in the fintech space. You can register now with the code BBanksDevR20, and you get a 20% discount. Now, if you don't remember, we had a few weeks ago, when we were talking about blockchain, we had the guys from MIT in talking about how blockchain should be legally defined. Well, yesterday and today, they've been at Senate hearings in Washington, D.C., trying to hash out whether or not there should be a legal definition for blockchain. So we're watching with interest how that goes over in Washington and sort of see how that goes. So anyway, a quick shout out to our good pal Ron Shevlin, who's tweeted in about the show. Hey, Ron, good to have you with us again. And if you've got any snarky comments like Ron might have, then don't forget to tweet us out using the app Breaking Banks 1, or you can tweet myself at Brett King, and Dave is at Born on July 4 on his Twitter handle. So you can tweet him out as well as we go on the show. We have joining us a few guests today. We have from Quartz, Eshe Nelson. Is that how I say it?
It's Isha.
Isha, sorry.
No worries.
My goodness. I've got this thing at the moment. I can't get the names right on the show. I don't know what's with that. It's like my brain has changed. So we're going to be talking to Isha about ING and their attempt to replace humans with robots in a moment. And Isha, what do you do over at Quartz?
I cover economics and markets, but really I write about anything to do with business and finance, and I'm based out of London.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us all the way from London. We also have on the phone Sam Hodges, who's the CEO, the co-founder and US Managing Director for Funding Circle. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brad. Thanks for having me on the show.
No problem. So you're responsible for overseeing the strategic direction, day-to-day operations of Funding Circle in the US. And how are things going for you guys in the US?
It's been good. We're experiencing really strong growth going here into the back half of the year. As probably not surprising, there were some ripples through the market in the first half of the year in marketplace lending, alternative credit more generally. Some of those, very specific to some platforms, some more generally, just given the macro environment. But I think we've weathered that quite well. And certainly here in the U.S. as well as across the rest of our global business, we have operations in the U.K., Germany, Spain, and the Netherlands. We're really excited about, how Q3 went and how Q4 is progressing, and looking forward to a really strong 2017 as well.
Fantastic. And we've got Andre Cherney also on the phone. Andre, you're on?
Yes, hi. How are you doing?
Good. So you're the CEO of Aspiration Bank, and tell us about Aspiration. We've had you guys on before, but for those who aren't familiar, what's Aspiration?
Yeah, great to be with you. Aspiration is a financial firm with a conscience and bring a whole series of different kind of financial products to people. We have a checking account that was named the best checking account in America by Money Magazine, investment funds, including a sustainable investment fund, and have a kind of a business model that lets our customers both do well and do good at the same time. So we've been really excited by the kind of growth that we've seen over the past year and a half. And it's great to be on with you and Sam and the other guests.
Great. And Deva, who's sitting in the studio with us, what's your official title at Fiserv, Deva?
I am the Director of Innovation and Insights at Fiserv, Fred. So I've been there for the last year and a half. Prior to that, I used to work for a bank, so I came from a banking background, and it's actually good to be at Fiserv doing what I do. I work very closely with some of the most largest and mid-sized banks within Fiserv, some of our Fiserv clients, to promote digital banking and all the innovative products Fiserv has.
Great. Well, thanks all for joining the show. So listen, I want to get straight into it, and I'm going to ask Andre the first question out of the gate here. Andre, with all this Wells Fargo fuss that's been going on in over the last few weeks, Aspiration has taken the opportunity to sort of stick it to the man, and you guys have been really sort of trying to advertise around this shortcoming of Wells. For those that aren't familiar, how have you approached this from an advertising and marketing perspective, post the Wells Fargo disclosures?
Yeah, we've been really direct about the kind of challenge that this presents to the entire industry. We see it less as sticking it to the man or trying to take advantage of the woes of
if the man is John
Stargo, but really see it as very much in line with our approach and with what makes Aspiration special. Get to the heart of it, the problem at Wells Fargo was really a problem of incentives. It was really a problem built around a financial industry where the incentives were to try to collect as many fees as possible from the clients in as short of a time as possible. We have a very different approach at Aspiration. Our approach is what we call pay what is fair. The customer decides what to pay us. If they want to pay us zero, they can pay us zero. We really see it as up to us to earn that fee from them. And to show them that what we're doing is worthwhile. And what that does is it really changes the kinds of incentives that we have. Our entire incentive is not around how many accounts can we open for customers, how much can we wring out of them, but how happy can we make those customers, how great of a service are we providing to those customers, and if we do a good job, they're going to reward us, and we see that over 90% of our investment clients choose to pay, even though all of them could be paying zero, and they choose to pay a very fair amount. And so what we've done with Wells Fargo in this kind of crisis and this moment of crisis, I think not just for Wells Fargo but for our entire industry, has been to really be upfront about the challenge that it presents to what we stand for as a financial industry. We've put out a number of different kinds of blogs. We've had some ads that have been running on social media, really talking about the difference between Aspiration's approach and Wells Fargo's approach. Again, not because we take any pleasure in the woes of Wells Fargo and certainly not in what's happened to their customers, but because we think that this really gets to the heart of the challenge that fintech should be addressing, which is the challenge of trust.
And if we have a situation in reading where your blog, of customers...
Go ahead.
There's one blog I'm looking at here, Andre, which is How to Close Your Wells Fargo Bank Account in Six Steps. I could be mistaken, but I think you're getting a little bit of pleasure out of this.
Well, you know, we're not. I mean, I think it's an important moment. We don't get pleasure because at the end of the day, the person who pays the price here, is not John Stumpf or others. It's really customers. And you have a country right now where 8% of Americans say that they trust their own financial institution.
Yep.
And what that translates into is people who sitting on the sidelines of financial services, not engaging, and that's a problem we need to solve.
Absolutely. Yeah, I didn't think it was as high as 8%, so that's it's probably improved.
I think the whole idea of how Wells Fargo tried to solve this by having multiple accounts open, it's a fundamental issue of how banks really see customer loyalty, right? I mean, you know, when I used to work for a bank, you know, there was that goal which you used to set up, say, you know, open at least 6 accounts when a customer walks into a branch or, you know, even if they do an online account opening. Now, really, if you ask the question to yourself, just because they have 6 or 8 accounts, does it really translate into good profits? I mean, they may not be real good profits because, you know, many times when customers open that many number of accounts, they are not really transacting on those accounts. They just keep it empty.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So ultimately, having just, you know, 6 accounts or 8 accounts is not going to really help the bottom line of the bank. It helps the employees to probably try to sell those accounts for the wrong type of a motivation.
Mm. So let me jump in here and ask, Sam Hodges from Funding Circle. We've seen also Lending Club has had some difficulties this year, but as sort of a P2P lender in the space, how would you classify the differences between these types of issues that we're seeing? With the fintechs like yourselves, Funding Circle and Lending Club, what sort of problems do you expect that we're going to see emerging over the next few years?
Sure. So as you know, Funding Circle is a global lending platform focused on small businesses.
You guys started in the UK, right?
Over 20,000 small businesses get about $3 billion worth of credit. And I guess what I'd say is, certainly the Lending Club issue sent some ripples through the space, but I'd characterize them as just that. I'd characterize them as Lending Club issues. They don't really speak to any broader
kind
of issues in this model, meaning an asset-light model of forming capital and bringing in, great borrowers to get credit and bring in investors who are excited about that that yield product. I think that, obviously as these platforms, Funding Circle and many others, become more mature, it's absolutely incumbent on us to make sure that we operate with the highest standard of care for both borrowers and for investors. And along with that, also to be very thoughtful around regulatory compliance. And I think, whether or not the Lending Club stuff, would have happened, those general themes would certainly, still hold true. And so that's really what we're all about. It's about delivering a fast, fair way for a borrower to get access to credit, and making sure that we deliver on our promises both with our investors as well as with those small business owners.
Now, let me ask you this of all of you guys, and maybe Deva and Ish. You guys might have some thoughts on this. We've seen regulators increasingly in London, in Singapore, in Hong Kong, elsewhere, now start to sort of put these sandboxes together to allow fintechs some breathing room in terms of the traditional regulations. There are certain regulations in the United States, for example, around disclosures on a savings account, which are really very much written for the old, structure of a savings account that we defined, 30, 40 years ago. And, when when you start having these different savings experiences that don't work in the same fundamental way as you going to a branch and signing a form and getting a savings account, this requires a little bit of freedom from those very strict rules that have been in place that have been really sort of shadowing products as they've developed. So here's the question. Do you think regulators are doing enough to sort of get prepared for things like the blockchain and things that are going to be impacting this ecosystem over the next, 10 years or so?
Isha here, I'd say in the UK has tried to really be a leader in fintech. As you mentioned, the sandboxes, the FCA has created one of those so that fintech companies can get a start without kind of being slammed with fines, etc., for, if something doesn't work out for them. And to one extent, I say that they're definitely trying, but as always with these kind of things, regulators are one step behind innovation. And so it might not be possible that there's ever
enough. Regulators aren't innovators, right?
Yeah, they're not. So they respond to innovation as quickly as they can. And I think the sandboxes are a really great way of trying to acknowledge that they can't regulate on top of while people are trying to innovate, trying to give people that breathing space. But more can always be done to respond to companies that are kind of up and running already and saying, hey, we want to be able to do this particular thing. Can you approve us to do this faster than they are at the moment?
Yeah. I guess from our experience at Funding Circle, I'd agree with the comment. I do think that the UK is really a leader in thinking about regulatory reform. That being said, you're never going to have regulations being at the cutting edge of technology. And that, I think that's just a reality we need to accept. I would say in the US, I think the debate is really on two dimensions. One of which is, how do you want to balance consumer and systemic protections versus innovation and the ability for innovative ideas to take root and be tested. And the other big question, which I think is almost as important, if not more so, is at what level should these institutions be regulated? Because right now in the United States, you have an incredible patchwork of regulations where a business like us, Funding Circle, we have all of the states as our regulators, both on the borrower side as well as on the investor side, and then we also have many federal regulators as well. And frankly, over time, I do think that needs to be simplified because it just means the cost of doing business for an internet-based platform that wants to operate nationally is very high.
Well, the Fed just came out and said that they're going to have to take a look at blockchain because it might be of impact over the next few years. A bit of an understatement, isn't it, in terms of this. Let me ask you, Andre, I'll ask you this question. Given the wholesale lack of trust with financial institutions, and that's likely not to have got better as a result of the Wells thing, can fintechs take advantage of this by building unique experiences that build trust?
Oh, absolutely. I think they have to. That is, in my estimation, the heart of the promise of fintech is to provide a very different kind of experience for customers. If we don't do so, we're failing to meet the opportunity and the challenge of the moment. The reason that people are walking away from traditional financial companies is not just because of a lack of technological innovation or a lack of great user experience. It's because, as we talked about before, they just don't trust them. They think the incentives are very much out of whack. And it is a heads we win, tails you lose kind of a dynamic. So I think that what we as a fintech industry need to do is really think about that. Now, at Aspiration, what we've done is really build this pay what is fair model where we really change the equation so that the power is in the hands of the customers and we provide them that kind of confidence and trust that we're going to be always standing on their side and they can be assured of that. And then that translates into our products, whether it's our checking account, which we're able to offer 1% interest, so 100 times higher than really any of the big banks, no ATM fees, things like that haven't traditionally been possible before. And we're able to do so because we do change the dynamic and because our own incentives are about not wringing fees from the customers, but about serving that customer and providing the best possible experience for them so that they're so happy that they then turn around and are excited to be part of the Aspiration community.
Yeah, I've got a feeling about this, and I'll throw this out to you. It's definitely a big picture question, but you know what we see with the U.S. presidential elections right now, what we see happening in the U.K. with Brexit, all of this, it appears to me that maybe the problem isn't lack of trust in financial institutions. Maybe something has happened with the way transparency and social media and all sort of stuff is occurring, that trust is at an all-time low for institutions in general, whether they're government or finance. I know that's a pretty big thing, but what do you think that this is part of an overall trend that we're seeing societally because of the impact of the real-time world? David?
What essentially is happening here is people are more used to convenience these days. So when we say that, you know, we don't trust our financial institution, you know, you ask a regular customer, do you trust or don't trust your bank? They are not going to say that I'm not trusting my bank unless they have a bad experience with it. This incident to be an inflection point for them to start looking at alternate solutions. I mean, if you look at folks walking on the street, they do have regular banking accounts with many banks, the Bank of America's of the world, Chase's of the world, with no problems at all, right?
Yeah.
So the times when they really want to like go look for alternative solutions is they had this one bad experience where they're not completely satisfied with the experience they have, makes them to go look for alternate solutions. So,
yeah. So someone else had a comment there.
Well, this is Sam. I was going to chime in. I think at a high level, there's certainly a question of, you know, how trust is eroded for certain large institutions. That being said, in our experience at Funding Circle, there's absolutely an opportunity to build trust with a consumer narrowly just based on the quality of your interaction. Is it transparent? Is it efficient? Are you delivering a product that actually is a good match for what they need? And I think, you know, even within banks, there are certain banks that do a great job of delivering a trusted experience because they're very focused and they put their clients first. There are other banks that are inhibited by bad incentives, bad culture, bad technology and systems. And I think that's really where you're seeing people, you know, wanting to move away and find, you know, service providers that are a really good match for their needs. I think it's one of the pieces that is fueling the unbundling of banks. It's this question of focus, transparency, and trust.
Okay, so let me jump into the Goldman Sachs announcement this week. We saw Morgan Stanley gave a firm, Morgan Stanley. They gave a firm $100 million credit line this week. You saw that. And there seems to be a big opportunity here. In fact, Sam, your own CEO, Samir, he said it was the golden age for marketplace lending. So looking at the sort of this structural shift here, where now funding is, you know, sort of moving from bank to bank to bank to fintechs, is this signify a structural change in the way credit is moving around in terms of the industry? Sam?
Sure. So our experience about this is there are many banks, larger commercial banks, and certainly the wholesale banks like Morgan Stanley, like Deutsche, like Goldman, where there's a lot of interest in doing something with players. They've proven they can operate at scale and deliver a high-quality experience directly to customers. We have a number of banks who we've partnered with globally as well as in each of the geographies where we operate, where they're either referring customers to us so we can deliver a high-quality lending experience, borrowing experience for those customers, and or where the bank is actually buying credit through us, recognizing that we have cost-to-serve advantages as well as technology and experience advantages that they can benefit from. So I do think you're seeing that kind of reformation in the financial services space. I'd say it's part of a broader arc trend, which is, you know, you're just seeing a kind of a shrinking in the number of independent institutions in the U.S. banking system, right? Going from 18,000 depositories, independent depositories 20 years ago to probably closer to 6,000 today. And frankly, the consolidation in the space going along with that. Banks have a lot of stuff they have to worry about, you know, particularly on the regulatory front. And so, you know, oftentimes they are looking to partners like Funding Circle, some others of the players that you mentioned to deliver high quality services for certain of their customers.
Yeah. I did note that, you know, in terms of sort of the regulatory shift around this, you know, the the response to the problems Lending Club has had has been pretty measured. There's been no immediate reaction to that. So I think there's a willingness on the part of regulators maybe to sort of see how this plays out in terms of these sort of lending practices. But the CFPB is still on the game in terms of payday lending and stuff like that. Do you think that we have to make a move towards more less structural types of regulation and more experience and consumer-based regulation? What do you guys think?
This is Sam again from Funding Circle. Brett, I think it's a really great question. I guess from our perspective, you know, we operate in the U.S., which takes much more of a rules-based approach. We also operate in the U.K., which takes much more principles-based approach. And from a regulatory perspective, both, I think, have their merits, right? I would say one disadvantage of many of the rules-based approaches that some states and some federal regulators here in the U.S. have, they have a lot of regulations that don't actually tie to any benefit or protection for the end consumer, right? They're written because of some reason, you know, some factor that was considered
so
maybe years
systemic.
Ago. But at the end of the day, you can't trace it back to, you know, this is either good or bad for the end consumer. And so I do think that, you know, if, you know, my advice to regulators would be try to look through that lens as we go through a period of time where there might be an opportunity to reform some aspects of regulation. You absolutely need it. You need consumer protection, but that really should be the purpose, not just following rules because they're there.
Okay, so let me ask you this question. Chris Larson, who's from Ripple, CEO of Ripple, he said, the next president of the United States should have a fintech advisor. So let me ask you this, you know, what does the next president, you know, what does she need to do in terms of fintech support and structure?
She should select you as the advisor, Brett.
She should what?
Select you as the fintech advisor.
No. That's interesting. Keisha, do you have any thoughts?
I mean, definitely there needs to be something. We have a UK fintech envoy, which has gotten a lot of appreciation here in the UK for having someone in the government who is really trying to focus and is like ensuring that there's research being done, ensuring that companies have someone to go to and have a voice heard. So yeah, the next president of the US should definitely make sure that fintech is being considered and that you're not just thinking of finance as a separate thing. You know, finance and business is such a huge part of the US economy. It needs to take into, you know, you need to take into account where it's going and where the future is. And clearly fintech is part of that, so it'd be, you know, it'd be very silly to ignore it.
Does anyone recall the term fintech coming up at all in the presidential elections thus far?
I mean, the election debates have been a bit off your usual topics anyway, so it's a question of how much focus there has been.
I can't say I've heard anything in the debates. It's also a shame we haven't really heard all that much about small business, which is, you know, obviously near and dear to our hearts at Funding Circle. And I would say certainly the next president has, I think, an opportunity to put some thought into both. I mean, the simple fact is, you know, financial services are a huge chunk of U.S. GDP, yet, you know, Americans overwhelmingly have issues with many of the financial services providers. And there are a lot of structural problems, both in terms of experience and, frankly, availability of things like credit. And so, you know, I think we have to, as a country, kind of get on board with the fact that we should be asking for a better system, and that's going to require some change.
Absolutely. All right, listen, guys, let's take a quick break, and then we can get back to I want to talk about this ING announcement that they're replacing 6,000 staff with machines and talk about sort of the automation effect that's happening in financial services as well and fintech. But before that, we have to go to a quick break. So a quick shout-out to our sponsor, Temenos. Ben Robinson at Temenos, he just wrote a post about the four business banking models in the digital age. You can check it out on breakingbanks.com. Just look for articles there. But stay tuned, tweet us out, and we'll be right back with more Breaking Banks after this break.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
Hey guys, it's Brett King from Breaking Banks. If you've ever listened to my podcast and enjoyed it, you'll know I focus a lot on the future. When you look at artificial intelligence, robotics, self-driving cars, smart infrastructure, smart cities, health tech, gene editing, computers everywhere that are smart, this is going to have major impact in the way we live our life and the way society interacts. That's the subject of my new book, Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, which comes out in the first week of May. Ramez Nam, the Philip K. Dick Award-winning author of Nexus, said, "You need to read this awesome roadmap of the future that Brett King has created." Please go and check out Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, available on Amazon for order today.
The future of online TV is here. View exclusive content from your favorite talk radio hosts and new programs that you can't see anywhere else. Visit voiceamerica.tv today.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Hey guys, welcome back. This is Brett King. I am live here in New York. I have with me in the studio Dave Animali, who's the, what's your title again, Dave?
Director of Innovation and Insights.
Yeah, what does that mean?
I do a lot of innovation work with Fiserv.
And it's very insightful.
Innovation. That's right.
Yes, and you're with Fiserv, so welcome. And we also have on the line the CEO of Aspiration Bank, Andre Cherney. Andre, where are you calling us from?
We're in Los Angeles.
Los Angeles, okay, on the West Coast. And Sam, you're in the U.S. Where are you?
We're based in San Francisco. We run our U.S. business out of SF.
Okay, cool. And Isha, you're in London, as you said. So thanks for a bit of a global show today. So we were just talking just before the break about this announcement that ING is going to replace 5,800 employees with machines. Now, this is the first of many announcements we're going to hear of this ilk over the next 10, 20 years, and not just in financial services. All of the, Isha, you did a study on this on Quartz, or you did a piece on this on Quartz. So mm-hmm. Can you give us a little bit more background on this and then sort of what the fallout of this announcement has been?
Sure. So ING is a big Dutch bank, and over the next 5 years, they're planning to get rid of a hefty amount of their staff. It's 5,800 jobs will be lost in the Netherlands and Belgium, plus another chunk of jobs will be affected. And this amounts to about 10% of their global workforce. So it's quite a lot of people that are going to be affected by this, by these changes. And basically, they're hoping to save about 900 million euros a year from cutting their workforce, but they will be investing 800 million euros in technology, and so that, yeah, it's a huge, they're calling it a big digital transformation. It's a very long 5-year project that's going on, but as you say, it's, this is kind of what's happening in European banks at the moment.
Yeah. So we are in this space. I mean, if you look at both Funding Circle, Aspiration, even our startup Movin, we have tried to design humans out of the process. So does fintech equate with less human workers in the financial services space?
I think definitely. I mean, especially for your traditional banks. Your traditional banks have a lot of people in back office jobs all over the country, all over the globe sometimes, working on similar projects. And on top of that, you have thousands and thousands of brick and mortar branches that people are supposed to be going into. And frankly, they're just surplus now. You don't need that many branches. You don't need that many people. So a lot of the jobs that will be lost to ING for a start will be people working in branches. They're cutting the number of branches down from 1,200 to 650 in Belgium alone. And then other jobs, it's people who are working in HR, who are working in IT, who are working in risk management and finance. They're going to find that their jobs are being centralized, that the technology behind what they do is being standardized across all the different infrastructure and data, which just means that you need less people. It should be much more efficient.
I wish I'd predicted that, Dava. The decline in branches. Sorry. Let me ask Andre this one. Andre, if you were to have built Aspiration 30 years ago, you know, in a sort of a typical FI approach, and you'd have to go into a branch to open a bank account, how much bigger would your organization be in terms of staff than what it is today?
Well, it's not just a hypothetical. 30 years ago, there were financial firms that were geared around serving what you can call the middle class. If you'll recall, you had a Dean Witter in every Sears in America. And then there was the E.F. Huttons. There was the, a whole series of different kinds of financial firms of that kind of ilk, where you had a person who was paid to go put on a suit and tie and sit behind a desk in a Sears and try to bring financial products to everyday people. Certainly with banks, it was the same. And the challenge was, as we saw, was that that kind of model just didn't scale to be able to serve people who individually had relatively small amounts of money compared to the kinds of multimillionaires that that Wall Street has increasingly served. And what that meant was that either you'd have very high cost of customer acquisition, or even more, to make that model viable, you'd have to layer on more and more fees on top of customers and give them service that was less and less geared towards their own success. That's really where technology, I think, allows you to come in and create a very different kind of experience, one that doesn't necessarily replace human interaction but scales it and brings the very best of what that kind of interaction was into a online or mobile experience that can be personalized and that can be dedicated towards providing really quality service to an individual.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's clear. So, Dava, maybe in terms of the role that you have at Fiserv, and in terms of the impetus behind these sort of innovations, do you now start to see the bigger banks writing checks for more automation, where they're basically designing humans out of the system?
I would say that there is a lot more impetus in offering digital-based solutions, which basically provide more customer satisfaction. I don't think that the banks are out there to typically get rid of their human workforce, but the digital solutions which they're trying to acquire from Fiserv basically provide a more convenient, better, customer-delighting experiences, which actually makes sense. If your mobile device can provide the solutions you want, that in its effect, reduces the amount of visits a specific customer has to do to go into a branch. So in fact, we did a study, Brad, which actually talked about digital engagement intensity in Fiserv, and we actually worked with one of the larger banks in the West Coast, and we realized that, with the right type of digital solutions, the customers were more happy, their branch footprint obviously reduced, and they were actually more profitable in the long run.
So, we've seen a huge investment in compliance technology over the last 10 years. In fact, I remember seeing an article, I can't remember exactly where it was now, but suggesting 60 to 70% of IT spend over the last decade. It was from an article, actually, article study showing that 60 to 70% of IT spend have been on compliance in the last few years. Now, compliance is an impact of regulation, but do you think the structure of regulations are going to have to become sort of higher level, talking more about experiential stuff and getting less into the weeds of the structural elements? Is regulation going to have to change to adapt to this new automated world as well?
I believe so. I believe that some of the regulations we still have in place dictate how you basically handle your paper-based processes. I mean, we all know about the wet signature process, Brett. I know you like to really take on that one specific topic where banks should not be using wet signatures to validate identity. It does no one any good, any use. I mean, those signatures are collected. They get stuck in some file locker there and they never actually get seen again. So there is no reason to actually impose regulations on processes which don't do you any good. But at the same time, one of the things which we fail to look at is we are seeing newer forms of user interactions, user experiences coming into play. I mean, are regulations actually taking time and effort to look at addressing yourself to see, are we making it better for, let's say, handicapped people to actually engage with those digital experiences? Not a lot of newer fintech startups who come there, you know, I don't think they really put that amount of thinking into that, at least from what I could see, that does this actually help some of those handicapped folks or visually impaired folks from engaging with those experiences?
Okay, so let's ask Sam this one on Funding Circle, Sam. You know, we're seeing sort of a structural change to the lending market here, moving away from the traditional sort of credit scoring mechanism to sort of more behavioral and things like that. How would that have an impact on regulation, do you think, over time?
I think it's a great question. I think it's frankly very much an emerging space. You know, at Funding Circle, we obviously make commercial loans, and so, you know, the work that we do, the way our models are geared, really is around the performance of the underlying business to which we are making the loan. We use some consumer credit information from a cutoff perspective, and it's factored in, but it really is a minority of the signal. Now, as you think about layering in additional data to potentially use over time, there obviously are some concerns. What if, you know, you end up having a model that auto, you know, updates, and it ends up targeting a population, you know, based on ethnicity or gender or, you know, perhaps a part of the country that, you know, has some overlay from that. And I think it's going to be really important that we think about, you know, things like disparate treatment and disparate impact in a way that is appropriately modulated for a business that is distributing primarily through digital channels. So I think that is yet to play out. I think it's going to be an important question.
Yeah. Andre, you know, in terms of investment, the same thing. There's been a lot of, you know, FINRA rules and things like that, and they've had a hard time adjusting to things like social media. You know, how's it going to adjust to robo-advice where, you know, you, for example, you know, how do you tell a robo-advisor, you know, that you accept a certain level of risk?
Well, yeah, I think that's certainly one of the challenges of the online investing world. We're not a you know, a classic robo-advised platform in the sense that our
current
products are all actively managed. But nevertheless, we still are assessing risk of customers as they're coming on and trying to make sure that the products we offer them are suitable. And really, it's going to be a process of really updating some regulations that are clearly outdated. And there has to be a better answer other than, this is the way we've always done it, because that hasn't really been working for consumers. And so, you know, some of these classic questions about how do you sleep well at night if you lose 10% of your investment don't really provide a great answer in an age where you're able to use data and metrics and a whole host of other sources of information to provide a much more nuanced and much more deep dive into who these customers are. That's what we do with some of our algorithms that we've developed. But it's a constant struggle to help regulators understand that we are trying to make sure that we reach the exact same kinds of standards that they're looking for, but maybe are trying to do it in a different kind of way.
Isha, maybe just sort of as your experience as a journalist and reporting on this ING thing and seeing the political environment right now in the United States, you know, how is, you know, a country like, you know, countries like the UK and the US who are really concerned about immigrants coming in and taking jobs and things like that, how are they going to respond to robots coming in and taking jobs?
Good question. I think people are can be quite fearful of automation. It's the next step of globalization, is you also have technology that comes and takes over. So I think there needs to be, in the same way that when we think about globalization, when we think about technology, a sense of what policies should government be putting in place to help people who are losing their jobs to new technology. You know, if you've got robo-advisors and banks, RBS just announced that it's launching at the end of the year an AI-powered customer service system, which I'm sure will reduce a lot of the number of people they need doing customer service eventually. So you need to think about what happens to these people, how can they be retrained, how can they be kept within within the system and within the labor market and not ignored. And that's something that hasn't really been addressed and definitely hasn't been solved. I know the UK is currently so distracted by Brexit and what that's going to mean, that it's quite a challenge to wonder how we're going to deal with these issues when there's so much other stuff going on. But it is important, you know, there needs to be more of a focus on how do you compensate these people.
Yeah, and this is Sam, just to chime in quickly. Yeah. I don't think this problem is in any way unique to financial services, right?
No,
we all know that in the short and medium term, technology is deflationary, right? You look at the number of jobs that have basically been taken out of things like local advertising based on the advent of, you know, Google and Facebook, and it's just enormous. Within financial services, I think there's a potentially a bright lining to this, which is there are a lot of people who are currently doing important jobs that technology can do really efficiently, and those people can be, you know, employed productively elsewhere in the system. So from a structural basis, in the near term, absolutely there need to be government policies that help with things like workforce placement and re-education. But in the medium term and longer term, I guess my more optimistic point of view would be, you know, we can figure out how to get those people doing things like building great small businesses themselves, which then digital lenders like Funding Circle can help serve.
So I think, Brett, you asked an interesting question that, you know, should the next president of the United States have a fintech advisor? I think this person should also be a future advisor, and not just a person, but a panel, right? I mean, we are in a very interesting cusp of time where we talk about AI, machine learning, robotics, taking away jobs for humans in the next decade, two decades, three decades. So I think we have to start thinking about how do we train, you know, our workforce to be more of an intelligence-based economy rather than, you know, an industrial economy, right? I mean, we need to really think about what are all the ways we could redo some of the foundational aspects of how we provide education to the next generation.
Yeah, absolutely. We've only got a few minutes left, guys, because we've got Ron with the moment of snark coming up to close out the show today. But let me just sort of ask you all for your input. In terms of the political race, you know, only 3.5 weeks left in the U.S. before the election. Who do you think would make the best candidate for the future of fintech?
I'll go out on a limb and
on that one, right?
I've not been shy about my own political views, so I'd say if the future of fintech is tied into the future of the country and the future of the free world, then I'll be voting for Hillary Clinton.
Okay, Deva, do you want to say
same here? Yeah.
Okay. What do you think from the UK there?
Well, I didn't get a vote, so it doesn't make a difference. But yeah, I think the point there is also, I do have an opinion, of course. The point is, yeah, if the future of fintech requires technology and finance and the economy to prosper, then you get a sense that Clinton's economic plan is probably more thought through than what we've been presented from Donald Trump so far.
You know, I have a fairly simple approach to this, which is I think climate change and the discussion of the science around climate change is a pretty good analogy for, you know, how technology is going to impact, you know, employment in financial services and other industries as well. And if you can't cope with the fact that clean energy is going to compete with coal and going to be a fraction of the price of coal within a very short period of time. In fact, it's already the case in the United Arab Emirates. They're signing electrical generation contract off solar farms right now at a third of the cost that the US generally pays for coal-generated electricity. If you still can't get your head around that, then I don't think you're going to be able to get your head around the fintech stuff as well. So I think I'm aligned with you guys in terms of Clinton v2 administration would probably be better placed. All right, so listen, guys, let me give you quick predictions before we finish up here. What do you think the regulatory environment's going to look like for fintech over the next 5 to 10 years?
I think it's going to be an interesting time for us, Brett. Like we said, you know, we're talking about AI, we're talking about machine learning. I mean, the current regulation addresses what we do right now, and it's still pretty complicated. Now, imagine, you know, you're underwriting, your loan rules and things like that using machine learning and other type of more complicated AI-based solutions. I think regulation
just becomes black box. Right?
It is. It is going to. We are going to be like, you know, walking in some uncharted territories here. So we really need to take a very good look at in terms of how we are going to design these systems for future.
Okay, so listen, we got to wrap up, guys. I realize we're running out of time. So, Andre, how can people find out about Aspiration Bank?
Go to aspiration.com and check us out. Join us. We'd love to have you. Or check us out on Twitter at Aspiration. Thanks for having me on.
And don't feel bad about closing your Wells account to join Aspiration.
Absolutely.
Okay. And Sam, Funding Circle, if you're a small business, where can we find out about Funding Circle?
We're at fundingcircle.com, and we're always looking for great small businesses, looking for credit, investors who want to invest in the product, as well as great people to add to the team. So thanks for having me on the show.
Fantastic. Isha, where can we read your latest stuff on Quartz?
Quartz is QZ.com, or all of our stories are on Twitter. The handle at QZ, so you should find us there.
What's your Twitter?
My Twitter handle is Isha Louise, so E-S-H-E Louise, or one word.
And don't forget to follow Diva as well. His Twitter handle at
Born on July 4th.
Born on July 4th. So very auspicious Twitter handle. That's it for Breaking Banks this week. Thanks for joining us, guys. Don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes. But here is Ron Shevlin with your Moment of Snark. And this is being spun out into a global a podcast for Ron as well. So check it out.
Hi, I'm Ron Shevlin, and welcome to another edition of the Snarketing Podcast. They say that you should never discuss race, sex, politics, or religion in proper company. Fortunately for me, you Snarketing Podcast listeners aren't proper company. But rest assured, there'll be no mention of race, sex, or politics in this podcast. I will, however, be discussing religion, and I may offend the religious beliefs of some listeners. I apologize in advance if you are one of them. In the world at large, there are many religions, and in the banking world, there may very well be many religions. But there are two whose adherents I come across nearly every day. The branchophiles, who believe that the branch is still the center of the banking customer relationship, and the branch adetivists, who believe that Branchamageddon is just around the corner, or maybe already here. Branchophiles love to cite statistics that show that consumers, and particularly millennials, still go into branches some number of times per month, ignoring the possibility that they do so because they can't get what they want done in other channels. Branchophiles also love to quote Vernon Hill, founder of Commerce Bank, who once said, when asked why his bank wasn't investing in online banking, "Nobody wants a relationship with a machine." The branch adetivists, on the other hand, love to trot out statistics that show a steep decline in the number of branches over the past few years, ignoring the fact that the decline may simply be a correction to the overbuilding of branches that occurred in the prior 10 to 15 years, or the result of merger activity in the industry. Branch adetivists would be more likely to agree with the comment that, sure, nobody wants a relationship with a machine, but they don't want a relationship with a brick either. Now, one topic that supporters of both religions love to discuss and fight about is the so-called branch of the future. There's no shortage of articles with really cool pictures of branch redesigns and pictures of the branch of the future loaded with cool technologies like interactive teller machines, kiosks, and iPads. Increasingly, however, I'm coming to the belief that the branch of the future has none of those things. What does it have? A desk and two chairs. I shared this belief with a banker at the recent BAI Beacon conference who told me that he was coming around to my point of view on this. He said, "My bank installed iPads in a number of our branches and nobody, and I mean nobody, uses them. It's just my opinion or a reflection of my branch religious beliefs. But I think the whole purpose of the branch going forward is to enable what technology is weakest at, physical, face-to-face interaction." A buddy of mine came into Boston recently, and I met him for lunch in the North End. Towards the end of lunch, he said, "Hey, I've got a client with a branch on Hanover Street." And a quick check of the map showed we were practically across the street from that branch. So I said, "Come on, let's go say hi." We went in, and my buddy gets a warm welcome and a hug from the branch manager. "Jeff, so good to see you." Trust me, I don't get that kind of welcome from my clients. Now, folks, this branch is tiny. There's room for just one teller window and one branch manager office. Yet despite its tiny size and lack of high-tech gadgetry, the branch is highly successful. Deposits and loan volume growth is very strong. Now, would you close this branch simply because you think branches are dying and the money is better utilized somewhere else? Would you install fancy kiosks and iPads for whatever purposes they serve because that's what the branch of the future is supposed to be about? Of course not. This branch is successful because it enables what branches are good for, enabling face-to-face personal interaction. Here's the challenge, though. technology is getting increasingly better at enabling face-to-face interaction thanks to technologies like FaceTime and enabling personal interactions through AI and chatbots where the customer doesn't even know that he or she is interacting with technology and not a real human. Not only that, but as Brett King writes in his book Augmented, technology is evolving to the point where we as customers will have artificial intelligent agents that represent us when interacting with the bank. Human employees of the bank might not realize that they're interacting with technology and not a human customer. Here's the bottom line. It's getting increasingly hard to see how more technology in the branch, technologies which could just as easily be used at home, in the car, or anywhere, is going to save the branch from extinction.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.